A quick note before you get into the podcast. We had a few technical issues when we were first recording this, so I've had to re-record a few bits. Sorry in advance for any audio quality issues, but hopefully it doesn't drive you too crazy and the content makes up for it. So without further ado, into the podcast. And welcome to episode 3 of the Corridor of Uncertainty podcast, the podcast where we delve into uncertainty, which we have a lot of at the moment. I'm Simon, and I'm here with my co-host Jamie. Jamie, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing quite good, Simon, thanks. Ready to go. Very uncertain. Yeah, lots to talk about, I think.
Yeah, there is a lot to talk about. It's been a pretty crazy season. How are you finding the start?
I think pretty wild. I think it's maybe always like this a little bit. You know, so long goes by in the season, you kind of forget what the start is like, and it feels like you're doing it for the first time almost every time you do it. I think like last few years it's felt like that to me, just taking hits all of a sudden, and you're getting pulled along by all these like hot takes and market forces of everyone making transfers and like so many millions of engaged players compared to what you get later on in the season. So feels really different every time, and obviously there's the stuff that's actually been happening on the pitch, which has been super wild too. So how are you finding it? How are you feeling about everything?
Yeah, I'm quite liking it. I'm quite enjoying the Wild West nature of FPL this season. Yeah, I think you raise a good point. You do forget what it's like when the market's going crazy and you're trying not to overreact to a couple of game weeks, and you're kind of constantly fighting your internal battle not to push the button on transfers that you know you're probably going to look back in 10 weeks' time and go, why did I do that? But no, overall, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, good stuff. No, it's fun to be back. And yeah, like we thought there was going to be a lot of interesting challenges for managers and that would be an unusual season. And so far, it seems like it's exactly that. So that's fun.
Yep. So we've got a few things lined up for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about what we've learned in the first 4 weeks, chuck teams back and forward to each other and think about how our evaluation has changed since the start of the season and whether we should expect it to continue. We're going to talk a bit about hits and whether you should take them, how to properly evaluate them, thinking about team value, thinking about when in the season to take them, etc. We're also going to talk a little bit about Timo Werner and what to do with him. And it kind of fits into our overall theme, which is what's happening.
I'm going to chuck you a team. I'm going to see what you think of them. So I'm going to chuck you Liverpool.
Aha.
What can we make of Liverpool from the first 4 weeks?
Liverpool are really hard to gauge because of the result in game week 4, I think. Before game week 4, they're really easy to gauge, and they actually had a sneakily good start, I think. They came out of the blocks really fast, especially in terms of their attack. And in my ratings, they were recovering quite a lot of the attacking strength that they lost towards the end of last year. And because they didn't drop any points, like they didn't do at the start of last season either, then all of a sudden the expected final points totals are like closing in on City already, which is exactly what we saw happening last year. So everything's looking great. And then we have this Aston Villa match. Alisson gets injured. I double up on Liverpool defenders before that news becomes publicly available, obviously. And they got absolutely hammered. And it wasn't, you know, the goals to expected goals in the game were wild, you know, lots of overperformance. But Aston Villa still put up 3.5 expected goals or something like that, which doesn't happen. Nobody does that to Liverpool. No one really does that except Man City or Liverpool to anyone. So that is a truly notable performance, I think. And it makes it very hard to know what to think of Liverpool now. I think they've conceded the second most expected goals against out of anyone in the league after that game. You know, they've played 4, some teams have only played 3, but I think they've conceded the second most expected goals, which is sort of unbelievable. And yeah, I don't know what to think. Like, now that Alisson's out, is this going to be, you know, massive defensive instability for a period of time? Or is it just going to turn out to be a blip? I mean, they had Mane out and Alisson out, two starters, two very important players. But from the sounds of it, they were just absolutely shook from the first minute to the last. So the next game is going to be really interesting. My sort of prior was, wow, Liverpool are looking really good this year. Better than maybe I expected them to, because I wondered if they might lose from having like reduced motivation from having won their first league in a long time. And now my model kind of is like back where it started with them, with a better attack and a worse defence. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, they're a weird one. My model agrees with yours broadly. I've got them slightly improved, actually, with quite a bit better attack and a slightly worse defence. Alisson and Adrian is worth digging into here. So by my numbers, I have Alisson as the best shot stopper in the league. He saves you about 10% of the value of the shots on target that you face. Whereas Adrian, I have as the worst of the current starters. So Kepa is a little bit behind, but obviously Mendy has come to take his place at Chelsea. And that by itself will shift the defensive numbers a little bit. So that shifts them in my model by 0.15 of a goal. Now, obviously that goes nowhere near to explaining the Aston Villa result. And there's this theory that Adrian accounts for extra defensive instability by being rubbish and kind of causing uncertainty in the defence. Maybe things around his distribution hinder Liverpool in build-up and invite pressure. And we had that little period at the start of last season, actually, where Alisson was injured again. I think you put a tweet up showing Liverpool's underlying defensive numbers didn't really shift at all. And that agrees with my model. So I'm inclined to think that this is just a one-off. Looking at the game, it seemed that a lot of the problems were in midfield. So one of the features we've seen this season is Gidi Wijnaldum is getting forward a lot more than he typically does. You can see that in his final third numbers, and you can also see it by watching the games. And I think that's leaving quite a lot of space in behind, especially with Henderson out. So I think they're getting a little bit overrun in midfield. Aston Villa definitely found a vulnerability there. So I wonder if they'll just revert to type, especially when Henderson's back, and move Gini Wijnaldum into a slightly more conservative role and put the creation primarily through the fullbacks and revert to type. That would be my prediction. So I wouldn't be selling Liverpool defenders at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the Liverpool fullbacks, obviously, as everyone knows and has celebrated how good they are going forwards. And I think Robertson has looked really good going forward and has got a goal already. And people are down on Trent, but I think it's because their expectations are maybe like unrealistically high. Like he's still putting up quite decent expected assist numbers from what as far as I can see. So I don't really have any like concerns over their attack being subdued or anything like that. If anything, they look even better going forwards. So yeah, it will be really interesting to see what happens once they get their full 11 back out again. But yeah, that's an interesting point about the midfield. I mean, I saw the Wijnaldum's numbers, especially in the first few weeks. He was putting up, I think he's had 7 shots or something like that. And last year, Liverpool got nothing from their midfield 3 going forwards. That was kind of the point. It was just all through the fullbacks and the front 3. So if they started to get something from their midfield, I wonder how that would work. You know, I wonder how they would manage to stay balanced with an expectation of having like Wijnaldum or maybe Naby Keita or people like that moving the ball like forwards and coming forward to try and get shots. That would be interesting to see. So, yeah, one to watch. Like, I'm not really going to put so much stock in the result. One thing that was interesting, I was having a conversation online, was betting markets are like have moved about 5% on the amount of goals that Liverpool are expected to concede in the near future. And that could be, some of that could be Adrian, some of that could be the Villa match, or it could be like a combination of the two things. I think my model had them going from a team that would concede 0.95 goals against an average Premier League team to 1.05 goals against an average Premier League team, which is like a 10% deterioration basically in quality. Now obviously that's coming from a very high start. They were the second best defence coming in, and they're still the second best defence now according to my model. But That's quite a big change for one match. It's one of the biggest changes the model has probably ever had from the results of one match. So, you know, we talked a bit last episode about updating in this Bayesian way, and there's quite a big update has taken place in probably both of our models. And the reason is because of just how surprising the result was, how much it subverted the expectation of the model. So it's going to be really interesting to watch that one. But I'm certainly not thinking about like selling Robertson or Trent at the moment as a result of that.
Yeah.
Shall I ask you about a team now?
Yeah, chat one to me.
How about Spurs?
I think Spurs are really good. So far, Spurs on the schedule-adjusted expected goals have been the best team in the league by quite a reasonable distance.
And they seem to have worked out how to attack under Mourinho. Now, I wonder, and this shows you what time we're recording, I've just seen a tweet that Son Heung-min is tested positive for COVID. So that may affect things in the next week or so. And
whoa!
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I saw it about 2 minutes before coming on to record and changed my transfer plans from knowing what I was going to do to having no idea.
So the model coming into the season had them as a pretty much average Premier League team, pretty much level with Arsenal. And Spurs in these four games have gone up in my model to be rated as the fifth best team in the league, whereas Arsenal have basically not moved at all. I've been particularly impressed with their attack. There's obviously a lot of hype around Son and the returns he's got. I mean, clearly the finishing is not sustainable. He's got 6 goals from 2 expected goals. But the numbers themselves are really strong. I think he's got about 2 expected goals and 2 expected assists in roughly 300 minutes. So really, really strong. I wouldn't necessarily expect it to continue at that level. Kane seems to have benefited a lot from actually having a rest over the lockdown period and not playing 90 minutes twice a week, 12 months a year. And they have Tanguy and Ndombele now that Mourinho has stopped inexplicably feuding with him. So they have ways to progress the ball. So yeah, I'm high on Spurs. I've been very impressed with them so far.
Yeah, pretty interesting one. I mean, I think it's fair to say that there was a general feeling that Spurs were doing worse than they should with the talent they had last season. But their decline had been so sort of unrelenting that you kind of wonder, well, are we overrating the talent? Was Pochettino maybe doing something that was getting more out of them than the sum of the parts? Or like are some of the guys just like shadows of their former selves, like Kane and Dele Alli and stuff like that? So yeah, it's been really interesting to see them come out of the gates so hot. Obviously, like you say, the finishing's crazy. I was looking at Son shots. He scored 6 goals, I think, off of 9 shots or something like that. 12 shots, maybe. So, like, you know, and none of them have been penalties. Something quite silly. I mean, he's a good finisher. You know, we'll probably get into finishing skill because this is the time of the season where you'll see the biggest amount of noise, and it's good to have like some priors around who are and aren't considered to be good finishers. Son is one of the best finishers in the league. He will outperform his XG probably, but yeah, too much at the moment. Kind of way too much, but doesn't mean he's not a good option. You know, he's been putting up really, really big numbers. Yeah, I'm looking at his points based on XG and XA, the expected points as per the FPL review model so far, are like 8 per game. And you know, a pre-match expectation for him, you know, based on what we know and what we think, a sensible expectation is somewhere between like 5 and 5.5 points, according to the what a model might have had or what the FPL review model did have. But what he's actually scoring is about 14. So you get a jump from 5.5 to 8, which is, you know, that's the gap between what we thought he'd do and then what the actual shots suggested he might do. And that can be because like he's just doing better. Spurs are playing better, or things went his way in certain games, you know, and some of that might be sustainable. And then you got a jump from 8 to 13.5 from finishing, like people finishing his passes or him just finishing his shots. That is totally unsustainable. He will get some of a bit of a boost there, like we say, but you know, it might be 20%, which here would take him, you know, would give him like an extra point point and a half, not an extra 5.5 points per game. So, well, what about Kane? I mean, we can't like not talk about Kane because he's been a favorite topic for like analytics people and also like FPL fans, because he was such an incredible asset for a couple of years in a row. Total shot monster, huge XG, good finisher, so reliable, and just like just absolutely amazing. And then he like falls off this this cliff because of, it seemed to be because of a build up of injuries and like constantly playing, like you say, never getting rest. And he kind of just seemed toasted. He just seemed like he couldn't do the things he used to do. Like I heard someone saying that his superpower was kind of being able to get these shots off in tight spaces with like not much of a pullback, you know, like basically, as I saw it, like being able to get shots off with quite a lot of power, quite a lot faster than other people normally would be able to. He just didn't seem to be able to do that anymore. And I've not seen him at all this year, but the numbers that he's putting up are absurd. And they're like easily the best in the league when you look at, you know, non-penalty goals and assists, expected non-penalty goals and assists. He has been monstrous. So are you going to be bringing Harry Kane into your team?
So one thing before I get onto Harry Kane, it turns out the Son news was fake news. And so if you switched off the podcast early, more for you. And if you're still with us, my apologies for slightly scaring you.
In terms of Harry Kane, yeah, it was a really interesting one. It seemed to be a particular ankle injury he got in, I think, April 2018. Before then, he was an absolute monster, like you say. And then I think he got rushed back by Pochettino.
And his numbers have just been in constant decline since then. And what's really interesting, and it seems to tally with the eye test, is that his expected numbers have just gone off the charts this season. So last season, in the whole season, so about 2,500 minutes, he put up 2.3 expected assists.
Uh-huh. In 353 minutes this year, he's put up 2.9. So there's clearly something going on here, because he's put up in four games worth what he put up in 30 games worth last year. And it seems to be working, and it seems to be working both for him and on the team level. So I think, I would expect that there's some error in these numbers. I don't think he's going to go at 1.4 expected goals plus assists over the year.
No.
And if he does, he's turned into Messi and England are going to win everything. But I think he's a reasonable option. I think I would probably prefer Son, just because he's £1.5 million cheaper and I would expect them to return at similar levels.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am as well. I did not expect him to be a good option coming into the season, and my mind is being changed like quite quickly. You know, I'm still not rushing to get him, but I see him as a credible option now, definitely. And I've kind of felt for the last year and a half that he's been a joke option. He's one of the first names that would spring to mind as like the biggest, most easy way to waste money in FPL. So it's kind of like quite a dramatic change for me and my opinion of Kane these last few weeks.
Yeah, me too. I think I called him a broken man on episode one. So I'll be smug about the things he got right. But I got that one very wrong. Very, very wrong. Okay, I can't talk about this without bias. So I'm going to give you Leeds.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, Leeds are quite a weird one, I think. We talked about them a lot on the first pod about how high we were on them, and they had a couple of wild results in the first two game weeks where they were like trading blows with Liverpool. But if you look at the numbers, they scored three goals off of four shots or something like that, five shots. It wasn't like a good attacking performance in terms of the shots that they managed to create. And whether you kind of think that's unfair to say it wasn't a good attacking performance full stop, I'm not sure. But like if you're just looking at those numbers, you'd say that it wasn't like anything to sort of shout about, but they got some good finishing. But then they beat Fulham 4-3, and we talked on the pod about how I noticed in the model from the Championship last year was that I expected Leeds to be relatively better in defence than attack, and I don't think that's something that's associated with Bielsa teams too much, because of the way he plays is quite kind of heavy metal and presumably you're trying to generate as many shots as you can out of the press. But that's what I expected. Their defensive numbers were excellent, better than Wolves in their promotion season, better than Sheffield United in their promotion season. Genuinely great defensive numbers for a team coming into the Premier League. And conceding 3 goals against Fulham is at home is not good for your defence. And the 2 games since then, they managed to go to Sheffield United and keep a clean sheet. That was nice. And then what was the score at the weekend?
1-1 with City.
1-1 with City, yeah. that was supposed to be an amazing game.
That's great.
They limited City to it was a brilliant defensive performance, was it not? They kept City to, like, pot shots.
Yeah, a lot of them, but no big chances. It was a really interesting game to watch. Leeds didn't have a touch for the first 20 minutes, and then after that we sort of worked away around the City press. So City were pressing Calvin Phillips really aggressively and stopping us in build-up, so we couldn't get out, and City just kept coming for the first 20 minutes. And they had like 10 shots, maybe 12 shots in the first 15 to 20 minutes. And then after that, Leeds dominated the game from 20 minutes through to 75 until Man City brought on Fernandinho. Leeds created 5 big chances, according to Opta. I think StatsBomb had our attack a little bit lower. But yeah, 1.5 expected goals against City, which is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great result, for, you know, in terms of like on the numbers as well. And then I see that something that I use is non-shot XG. I see that the 538 model actually quite liked City in terms of non-shot XG. I don't know how that rings with the kind of events that took place in the match, but the implication is that City were doing a lot of things that are typically dangerous, but they didn't turn into shots in this match. Like Leeds won on XG, but City won by quite a bit in terms of non-shot XG, which, you know, if you're getting, probably Leeds, I imagine, were outpossessed quite heavily, and that's, you know, going to be one factor there. So it's quite a lot of kind of contrasting information to, like, assimilate on Leeds, how we should think about them.
Just a quick one on the non-shot XG. Leeds had more of the possession against City. I think it's only the 7th time the Guardiola team anywhere has been outpossessed. I'd be interested to see the kind of time breakdown on the non-shot XG. So I think I could see how a model would see the situations that City were in as more dangerous and that they didn't manage to turn them into shots. I don't know how much of that is a feature of Leeds' defensive system and how much of that is a feature of City's poor attacking choices.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Interesting. Really interesting. Yeah, so I wonder where that non-shot XG number has come from then. But that kind of mitigated the boost that Leeds would have got in my model somewhat in terms of maybe the difference between how yours and mine would have updated from that City match. So all in all, I have Leeds as the 11th best team in the league now in terms of strength, which is they've just been overtaken by West Ham, who have been on a tear since lockdown and continue on one this year. So they've lost a place to West Ham, but that's not much at all. Their attack is looking better than I thought it was. It's improved by more than the average amount. Something we should definitely talk about is just the amount of goals that we're seeing in the Premier League so far. That deserves its own little section, probably. But their attack has improved quite a lot. I've got their defences going down by quite a lot, but not as much as some other teams. You know, everyone's defence has lost a bit. And I've got, like, Man United and Man City both losing more in defence in the start of the season. So they're a bit more attacking than I thought they were, a bit more competent in terms of attack, and they're pretty much the same team that I thought they were in terms of overall strength. Other people might not have this view of them yet. They might be coming to this view the more they get to know Leeds, but I would say very competent and encouraging start, and one that it looks like our models are about right on so far. No evidence to doubt, really, that Leeds are a mid-table team from what we've seen so far. So, yeah, exciting stuff for Leeds fans, if you know any.
Should we talk about the number of goals now, then?
Let's do that. Why don't you talk about the number of goals that we've seen? I see a lot of people saying, oh, there's no fans now, and it's that somehow means that there's going to be a hell of a amount of goals in the English Premier League, or it's crazy. You know, you got Man U losing 6-1 and Liverpool losing 7-2 on the same day. So tell me about what you think about these goals and what we should expect to see going forwards.
Let me just try and break it down a little bit. So
I think the first thing I'm going to say is that we've seen some pretty bad goalkeeping. So we've seen 122 post shot expected goals against. So that's based on where the shot was aimed in the goal and the kind of power on it, how likely it was to turn into a goal, also taking into account things like the location, etc. And goalkeepers have conceded an extra 19 goals on top of that. So goalkeepers are performing under by about 15%. So we've seen some pretty bad goalkeeping, for one. We've also seen a lot of penalties, as we all know, even compared to what we thought going in, which is an increase in the number of penalties. We've seen even more. And I think the handball only goes part of the way to explaining that. I think part of that is just a freak occurrence. Part of that's probably the way it's refereed. I think I'd expect it to calm down a little bit from where we are now, but still be at a quite significantly higher level than we saw last season. And we've also just seen some great finishing. So I think the expected goals per game is up by about like 0.1 or 0.2 over the course of both teams in a match. So we're seeing slightly more open games, but a lot of it is down to finishing, and it's mostly a finishing quirk. So I think I wouldn't write off clean sheets yet. I would adjust your models to take into account increase in penalties, which will reduce clean sheets a reasonable amount. But I think we'll start seeing goalkeepers make saves again, which will be a novelty. And we'll also see the finishing calm down a little bit.
That's exactly how I have it. So I've got some numbers here too. And just looking at non-penalty XG per team per match, last season, 1.23 expected goals per team per match, non-penalty expected goals. This year so far, 1.16. It's 5% down in terms of non-penalty XG on last season so far. So just very much within the margin of error, you would just say there's no evidence to suggest that there's a difference in the amount of expected goals that teams are going to generate so far. Penalties, like you say, is a real thing. We kind of talked about that on the first pod. And we have, once you include the extra penalties, we're up to about maybe plus 5% or plus 7% expected goals overall this season. Then once you include the finishing, we are up to 41% more goals. We've had 1.9 goals per team per match against 1.3 last year. And like you say, a lot of that finishing is coming seemingly on the goalkeeper's side, where the shots have been, you would have expected them to be saved at a higher rate. So it's going to be interesting to see like what comes out of that. I saw that Jonathan Liu wrote a little article for The Guardian about this like wild start and what we should think about it. And, you know, he was suggesting that the absence of a proper summer break, where a lot of how a defense works is by repetitions and drills and kind of like ironing out these little creases over time, and that because of like not having this time to do that, then that might be a reason why teams are suffering. I'm not sure what it's looked like in other leagues so far. I meant to check, but I haven't really seen it. But I know that the same thing isn't happening in the Championship, albeit they would have managed to have a bit of a longer break because none of their teams are involved in Europe after the season and stuff like that. So it's a bubble at the moment, in my opinion. I think we've had 6 handball penalties that we wouldn't have had last year, and they've already kind of hinted that the way that they're going to adjudicate it going forwards, there would only have been 4. You know, 2 of those would no longer be given under the kind of new guidelines that they're supposed to be working under. So probably some of those other extra penalties, because there have been other extra penalties, are just kind of accidents or short-term effects or weirdness that's going on. But yeah, I think overall, we're just seeing a really strange amount of goals, which I would expect to settle down once teams get fitter, once they get more time with each other to bed in, and maybe even after the international break. I would think that this is going to start, the air is going to start coming out of the balloon a little bit on the overall goals that we're seeing. I'm still spending quite a lot of money in defence on my FBL team, like I tend to do, and I don't have any real concerns about that too much, you know, to move the money around or anything. Like I said, I just doubled up on Liverpool defenders, which meant putting a bit more money in my defence prior to game week 4, and yeah, we all know how that went.
Yeah, I think you're not going to see Liverpool conceding 7 every week, so I wouldn't beat yourself up about it. But yeah, I agree. It's mostly a bubble apart from the penalties. And I think you should expect to see, I think the markets have it at around 50% increase on the level of penalties we saw last season going forward. And that's going to impact your defense overall. I think it's going to add about 0.15 goals. And that's going to reduce the value of defenders across the board. So I'd call it a minor concern. But again, I wouldn't read too much into 4 weeks.
Yeah, agreed. I just thought of a good team actually to do, because everybody's talking about them and how they're the best team in the league, which is Aston Villa. We didn't really talk about them when we talked about Liverpool Aston Villa. Do you have any Aston Villa takes, players or team?
Aston Villa's a really interesting case. We need to talk about their defence, because this is one where I think my model is probably lagging some signal. We saw Aston Villa be the whipping boys, and they were the worst defence in the league by a reasonable margin, like a good 0.2, 0.3 goals, worse than the 19th best team in the league going into the break last season.
And worse than Norwich.
By quite a long way. They were really, really bad.
So we have 13 games for Aston Villa since the lockdown. That's a reasonable sample. It's a third of a season. It's not just to be discarded. And we've seen my defensive ratings in my model kind of creep up and up and up and up. And they seem to be catching up to where their new defensive level is. And it still has them as the 18th best defense, though. So not great. And that includes the signing of Emiliano Martinez, who is an above average shot stopper. But I think they're probably better than that. The question is how much better and what's their real level? Now, I'm not sure they're best in class. If I had to kind of look at it and think, where would I evaluate them? I'd probably say somewhere in mid-table. Now, their attack is the other interesting side of the coin. So I have their attack as improving by more than their defense this season. I have Villa as the second most improved team overall so far this season. And they've signed a lot of good players. They've stopped shopping in the Belgian league, which is good. They've got Ross Barkley in. They've got Ollie Watkins, who obviously did very well at Brentford in the Championship last year. He's a really classy player and seems to have adapted to the Premier League well so far. I think they're a good team. I think they're legit. I think they won't be in a relegation fight. I think they'll finish comfortably in mid-table. And the question is, how high in mid-table will they finish?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's an interesting effect that you made me want to talk about in the models that we have, where you're kind of updating in this like Bayesian spirited way, and you're moving a little bit in a one direction based on new evidence. Now, if something happened with Villa that meant that there was like just a sudden change in their ability post lockdown, it might take our model quite a while to reach that level, because it's meant to update responsibly on the new information that it sees. It's almost built on the assumption that improvements or declines that you see in teams' levels will be gradual, and that generally they're operating around a kind of quite a fixed kind of base. But one thing that I saw with Spurs last year in my model was they started off the season, you know, pretty high up, kind of joint third, fourth with Chelsea in terms of how good they were. And they had this disastrous start under Pochettino, and they're getting worse, 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 worse. Then Mourinho comes in. Now, people who were looking at the numbers, when Mourinho came in, their actual XG and the results and the goals did get better than it had been under Pochettino at the start of the season. But in my model, they continued to get worse, because you know, my model didn't rate them as bad as they were playing under Pochettino. It said, okay, well, we've had 9 or 10 games of a really good team playing really bad. What does that make them now? What it got under Mourinho was more and more evidence that they actually weren't the team they used to be. They were quite bad still. And so they continue to get worse in the model. And what that is happening there really is the model's catching up to the truth. You know, why that was the truth, I'm not entirely sure. But it was the truth for them last year that they just weren't that good. The model's catching up to the truth. And there might be an effect here that you hinted at, where our models are kind of catching up to Aston Villa suddenly being good, or, you know, a good team. I don't know. So that's something that you kind of have to allow for. Like last year, my priors at the start of the season weren't very good for Sheffield United. I underrated their defence quite a lot. And so what you got was like almost a whole season of my model's opinion about their defence continuing to improve. And maybe even if I had a good prior, that still would have happened, you know, but it would have caught up faster. So you can get these effects where we're trying to weigh the information in a responsible way. And that means you can sometimes understate the changes that are happening in real life, because you don't want to be on the side of risking overstating them either. You're trying to get it just right, and sometimes you come out on this side. So if Villa keep on performing really well, or if West Ham keep on performing really well, we're going to see our models kind of like just keep moving. And, you know, and some people might be there saying, oh, I told you so, I knew they were this good already. But, you know, what you don't see the other half of the time is when you get these teams that show flashes of brilliance, they don't always kind of stick around. So going to be a really interesting one for Villa. Watkins looks really interesting as a forward. Grealish is putting up huge numbers. There's like loads of finishing in Grealish's numbers as well. But the numbers are still big anyway. Lots of encouraging stuff from a like going forward point of view, touches in the box and whatnot. Villa, yeah, good apparently. Yeah, I've got them finishing mid-table basically, sort of along with Leeds and West Ham and Southamptons of the world, and not in a relegation fight as it stands.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things to add on the modelling. So your model is trying to wait when it sees a good performance, is this a flash in the pan or is this indicative of a true change in the level? So you want your model to be wrong in both directions a roughly equal amount of time. If it's reacting too quickly to every flash in the pan, then it's going to say Aston Villa are going to win the league and Liverpool are going to get relegated based on it just waiting the last game. And if you're updating too slowly, you're going to have the Villas of the world where your model hasn't caught up to the fact that their underlying level has actually changed. So if you have as many teams continuing on their trend as you do that fall back, then your model is probably well calibrated. But the way that the model works is that the more wrong it is, the quicker it will catch up. So even if you're catching up to, say, Sheffield United's defence for the whole of last season, by the halfway point in the season, you'll have caught up more than half of your error, since you'll catch up much quicker at the start of the season.
Absolutely, yeah, that's exactly right.
I think we've got time for one more team before we move on to the other bits. So I'm going to chuck you Manchester United.
Okay, that's a fun one, because Man U have moved a lot in my model as well this year. We've only had 3 games for United, and I think it's kind of like, you know, the Spurs game, you've got the early red and conceding 6 goals, and that's just, you know, like ridiculous. The Brighton game for me is the one that's most telling, the most interesting game, because they were outplayed by Brighton. Brighton are not a team that's known to have a good attack. They've started the season well. I've been impressed by the way that Brighton have started, but they were outshot, they were out XG'd, and they deserved to lose more than they deserved to win that match. And their defence last year, it was like a favourite topic of mine, was that when everyone thinks about Man United and like Fergie's Man United, they think of this kind of, you know, fluid attacking team that's just going to outscore you, and that's just not what Solskjaer's Man United are. They are a team that's just going to outpossess you. They're just going to possess you to death. You don't get shots because you don't have the ball, and that's where their defense looks good. You know, it was I had their defense actually as just about as good as Liverpool's by the end of last year. It was really, really stodgy. And then they get a Bruno penalty, and this is where they were getting a lot of their results. This year, their defence has, I'm not sure if there's like been good commentary on this, I've not seen why, has just looked awful in the games that we've had. Obviously, like the Spurs result is hard to get a lot from, but they'd or they were already 2-1 down at the time of the red, I think. But the Brighton game is the one that makes me think that something real is happening at the moment with how bad their defence is. So overall, nobody has lost more in my model than Man United this year. Their attack is about as good as it was, which is quite damning given everyone's attack has tended to get better because of the goals that we've been seeing, more penalties. And their defence has gotten a lot worse than it was. I had it from going from like just about like third, fourth best now down to sixth already. I rate Chelsea, Wolves and Leicester as having a slightly better defence than Man United in terms of what I expect to happen for the, you know, for the remainder of the season to estimate their level. So Man United have had a horrible start to the season according to my model. I am expecting them to come sixth at the moment in terms of points. I mean, there's so much like variability on this. If they come out and win next week and win well, and you know, Everton and Leicester have bad defeats where they play badly, you know, then all of a sudden they're projected fourth again. It's you know, there's so much variability in the estimates at this point in the season, but really bad start for Man United. I don't own any of their players, and before the season started, I would really like the look of Rashford. I thought he was the one who was going to be value / underpriced if one of them was. And he has looked all right, but I'm thinking less about him at the moment. I want to see them sort of steady the ship. How does that sound to you?
Yeah, I agree. So I think it's obviously comes with a small sample size warning, but so far on the games played this season, Man United have been the worst team in attack and the worst team in defence on the schedule adjusted numbers. They've been truly awful. The model still rates them around the kind of sixth best team because it doesn't overreact too much to that three games. But like you, they're the biggest movers downwards by quite a distance. And they've lost on both sides of the ball for me. So because of my model's only non-penalty, like you say, if they're standing still while everyone else is moving forwards, that will look like moving backwards in mine. They've been terrible, and I'm not sure why. I mean, they weren't as good as their last 13 games would have told you, but they weren't as bad as their first 25 would have told you either last year. And they shouldn't be the worst team in the league. Like, their schedule adjusted expected goal difference for me is minus 1.6 per game. To give you the context, Fulham are minus 0.9. So they've been quite a bit worse than Fulham so far this year.
What about and West Brom?
West Brom are minus 1.26. So West Brom and Fulham are 18th, 19th.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've got them finishing 8th at the moment. But like you say, in a pretty tight group.
Yep. And the red cards have a big effect in a small sample. You know, West Brom got an early one. Man U got an early one. That's going to hurt in a model like this. You have to decide how much you want to throw out of the Spurs game. But I think as performances go, it was a pretty dismal one for a team that had gone down to 10 men. You know, like often you see those games stay close and that didn't happen. And then when you put that together with the Brighton game and with
the Palace game,
they lost
as well.
Another one. They lost at home to Crystal Palace,
and they didn't play well either. Their numbers were—they played even at home to Crystal Palace on their numbers, and they lost.
Yeah. So yeah, really worrying start for Man United.
Welcome back to the Corridor of Uncertainty podcast. We're finally going to talk about some FPL. I know you're probably bored of us just talking about football. And we've got a bit in strategy corner here, which is hits and when to take them. So it's kind of one of the things which is most hotly debated amongst FPL managers. Some managers love hits, some hate them. You see some taking kind of 30 hits in a season all the way down to one or two. And there's always a lot of debate over whether they're good, whether it's just a playstyle thing, and when in the season is kind of optimal to take them. So, Jamie, how do you think about hits and evaluating whether they're a good idea and at what points?
Yeah, okay. It's a good question. I've got quite an extreme kind of approach to hits, which is that I don't really ever like to take them, certainly not in the course of a normal season. And it plays to, I think, me being like somebody who likes to plan a lot, and you forecast, you make long-term decisions. You know, you're buying players who, like, for good reason that you expect to keep for a long time. The way I like to play the game is like that. You're buying long-term pieces all the time. And then you solve problems as the problems arise. That's kind of like my happy place for FPL. Hits would be like, for me, a hit's a planning failure. It's not something that I price into the moves I'm going to make. If you look at expected value and the expected points that a player is supposed to get in the next game week or over the next several game weeks, it's 4 points is a lot of points once you start becoming accustomed to the kind of unit that you're working with and expected points. 4 points with certainty is a lot of points to sacrifice. You better hope you're getting a lot of upside for that. And some people make it work really well for them. And I think that plays to style. I'm not going to say that there's like an objective right or wrong thing to do. I think that people tend to take too many hits, like your average FPL Joe. Probably, I think the main fail is underestimating the points potential of the player that you're selling. I think that's something that people look at the transfer in a lot more than they consider the transfer out, you know, and it's kind of easy to get into this situation where you see everyone else doing well, you think that your players are trash, and you sort of call yourself names for picking all these bad guys until you transfer them out quite happily, and, you know, even if it's for a hit to get some guy that looks great. But really, the people that you got, you probably got them for a good reason. They've probably got a decent points potential. Maybe they just haven't been catching some breaks and stuff. So I tend to dislike taking hits because it's kind of my style. But at the start of the season, when there's so many more engaged players and transfer prices are moving so fast and we're kind of finding out new stuff much faster than we are at the other parts of the season when things are more settled, it can be a worthwhile thing to do. And if you can take one or two hits to turn your game week one team into like a perfect long-term team and save your wild card, I think there's quite a lot of value in that. And, you know, there's some work that's been done on how much you should care about team value changes. So that might be a good thing to talk about too. But before I go on any more, I'll sort of check in with you. How do you feel about taking hits? What's your general approach like?
Yeah, I generally agree with a lot of what you say there, which is I think people tend to take what I call bad hits, which is when they're overreacting to a random outcome, which is a good player blanked in any given game week. And so therefore they just want red and they want the new shiny thing. And I feel pretty comfortable saying, kind of regardless of your style, that's not optimal FPL play. To evaluate a hit properly, you're absolutely right. 4 points in a single game week is a huge amount. And it almost, if you've picked relatively good players in the first place, you're almost never going to get a 4 point transfer in a single game week, especially when it's your second best transfer or potentially third best transfer if you've rolled one. But there's a few kind of downstream considerations that you need to take into account. So one is team value, like you've talked about, and we'll kind of get into the research that's been done on how to quantify it and how solid we think that is. And there's also the value of you buy yourself an extra transfer going forward. So if you're bringing forward a move you would have made earlier, then you have one extra transfer to use in all of your future game works. And that extra transfer has some value as well. I'm not sure I agree that the number of hits you should take is a style thing. I think we're all just kind of reaching around in the dark, not knowing what the optimal strategy is. And I think there is an optimal way to play it analytically. I don't know exactly what that is because I don't know how to evaluate well the value of an extra transfer or the value of an extra 0.1.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is an optimal style. We're just kind of uncertain of what that style is.
Yeah, I think that could be right. I suppose the note for me would be that that optimal style might be further away than some people's natural style or natural preference than it will be for other people. So you might actually contort yourself into an unnatural shape to the extent that your play becomes quite bad because it's not like you to make like long-term patient moves and stuff like that. Like somebody might play more impulsively. They might find it more fun. Maybe that keeps them more engaged. Maybe they play better, or maybe they kind of believe that they are good at spotting small things, maybe to do with the way that they watch the game rather than things they're seeing in the numbers, that might lead to like more immediate returns, and they're happy to kind of jump on and off players faster. You know, I wouldn't ever back myself to do that, but you know, I'm prepared to believe that sort of person exists.
I agree. I think everyone should optimize for fun, really, rather than for winning.
Yeah, I think that's good advice, and probably going to lead to the kind of like your best play more or less. There was some good work that FPL Research pointed out to me about the amount of hits that were taken in his elite sample last year, and it was something in the range of 5, I think, was the average. But each hit was associated with roughly 4 fewer expected points. So almost like saying the hit was getting you nothing. You were just paying for the hit and you weren't getting any benefit from it.
That's kind of wild. I thought it would be a smaller gradient than that.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing there is probably a correlation between players that are maybe like having bad years, getting bad luck, getting bad beats, and then having to take hits. And so like the players that are taking hits aren't like kind of in an equivalent situation to those that aren't.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like the bad beat kind of begets the hit rather than the other way around.
I think there'll be some element there, yeah.
Should we talk about the team value side? So there's kind of a few methods that I've seen, and all of them kind of lead to a similar kind of valuing of how much a million in FPL is worth. So
yep.
We think about value by kind of regressing the expected FPL points from a player against price. And that slope of your gradient gives you how much that extra million is worth. So when I do it on the whole season, I get about 18 points for 1 million of FPL money. And that translates into just under half a point per game week for a million, or just under 0.05 per game week for a 0.1. And that tallies with, I think, FPL Reviews done some work where they run their optimizer with different budgets and then kind of regress the team expected points against the budget. And that comes out, I think, with a similar value of 0.045 per game week. And so if you're avoiding a selling value drop of 0.1 now with 34 game weeks left, that's worth somewhere between 3 to 3.4 points on its own. So how much do you buy that? Sorry, yes, half of that. It's worth 1.5 to 1.7 points on its own. So how much do you factor that in when you're making your transfer decisions?
Yeah, so like right now, when prices are moving so fast, I factor that in somewhat. Whereas later on in the season, I factor it in not like almost not at all. Normally, I'm very kind of indifferent to price changes, and seeing my players rise or fall is fine. Like if people are selling someone I own who I think is good and I want to keep, that's fine because less people are going to have him. And when he becomes cheaper, you know, I get less money if I sell him. So it actually makes, it incentivizes you to keep that player. And if you already think that player is good, then that's fine. You know, you don't really need to worry about that. So at this point of the season, I do take it into consideration. I made some early moves that involved a hit in between game weeks 2 and 3, and that was because there were price change considerations. Like I had 0.0 in the bank if I did it at a certain time. The first move I had to do was a free transfer, but it was to do Ings to Jesus. And then I took a hit on doing 2 more transfers. I had 2, and those were my second and third. And they were also to do with price changes that were happening. I ended up getting KDB and Foden in for, trying to remember who it would have been now, Aubameyang. And doesn't really matter who. James Ward-Prowse, some rubbish player that I had. So there was a few price change considerations in there with me going early. And I thought if you're you know, if you're about to lose 0.1 on the player and the player you're going to buy and you really want to buy that player is going to go up 0.1, then you've got that 0.2 swing. And over the course of like 38 game weeks, that is just about the price of a hit that pays for itself. So that's quite significant. You know, if you think you're going to get a few points more and you think that's a better structure to be on and you're going to have like compound benefit from price changes and points that you get in the short term, it's kind of quite a compelling reason to take the hit. How about you? You took one as well, did you not?
I did take one. It wasn't really down to team value considerations. And in retrospect, it was probably a little bit of a mistake because I'm now planning to undo the structure that I got by doing the hit. But that's kind of unrelated to the fact that I took a hit. So yeah. I did it because I was going to get an estimated 2.1 extra points in expectation that game week. In the end, it cost me 6 plus the hit. So it didn't turn out well, but so be it. And that 2.1, and then I would obviously have the extra transfer going forward for the rest of the season, 38 transfers rather than 37. Mm-hmm. And I estimated that at around 2 points, which was pretty unscientific. But I can see like my second best transfer in any given week, purely by eye, and I think this is one of the under-researched areas of the game, would bring me about kind of 2 extra expected points, and it's a slightly conservative estimate. So it was a pretty marginal hit. So I put those 2 things together, and that was the 4.1 versus the 4-point hit. So it was a really kind of slim EV play, but I just felt like it was more fun as well.
Yeah. That's really good. You make really good points. I mean, I think what we're saying when we say that we don't take hits that much and we don't think that hits tend to be worthwhile with our style is that a second transfer is rarely worth 4 points. And your time horizon, you know, can be slightly more complicated than just saying one game week in general. But I find this to be true. Like often a transfer that you make will get you like maybe something like 1.5 points in game week, you know, in one game week. And then you hope that it gets you, you know, picks up some more halves and some more ones maybe in future game weeks. And it ends up getting you like a wee handful of extra expected points. But you don't tend to get moves that are like easily get you 4 expected points. You know, like blanks and doubles are a difference here. Like if you're not fielding 11 players in a blank, then straight away, if you take a hit, if you're bringing in someone who's expected to get more than 4 points in that game week, then it's going to, you can expect it to pay off on average within that game week. You know, what that does to the game weeks that are coming down the line, then you'd need to judge that yourself. But yeah, that's kind of what we're saying, which might surprise some people. I don't know. A transfer is probably not worth 4 points in general, which is why hits are hard to make work, is kind of my general steer. I'd certainly plan on not taking any more hits this year if I can possibly avoid it. I took another one between game weeks 3 and 4, so I've taken 2 in consecutive game weeks, and I've also done that like the last 2 seasons before this as well, around this exact same time, once the kind of landscape is starting to become a little bit clearer. I've taken a couple of hits to kind of drag my team into shape and avoid using a wild card. This season, I'm still pointed at the saving it for game week 16 with the idea of optimizing for these blanks and doubles that we've got coming up in 18 and 19. And you mentioned that was your plan as well. We could talk about wild cards as well, if you like. Lots of people I see are choosing to wild card in the international break. I find it hard to know enough to be certain enough about what we've seen that I'd want to change my team substantially from the game week 1 team. And maybe that comes down to me being too conservative in the way I update. Maybe it comes down to me actually planning longer term with my game week 1 team than other people did. You know, I plan to ride this out. How do you feel about wildcarding now? Like, have you thought about wildcarding yet this year? If someone made you wildcard, would you be confident that you could pick a good team?
I haven't thought about wildcarding, so I kind of mentally committed myself at the start of the season that I didn't have an early wildcard option, that I had a wildcard which I was only had available from game week 16 and had to use in that game week. So I kind of have mentally just shut myself off from it being an option. I think right now I would agree. I don't think I know enough about the landscape to be confident in my fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh moves that are going to be the more marginal ones anyway. So if I have two free transfers, which I do, plus a hit, I can change three of my squad. So if I really want to mix it up, I can change 20% of the players that I own into new players. You can restructure your team quite significantly. You can change your squad structure with three transfers. So in order to have the amount of information that I'd want to make my kind of fourth pick, my fifth pick, my sixth pick, that is different from my current team, I'm not sure I could do that right now. And I think we've seen it a lot in the community where people have taken early wildcards and then wanted to change their whole team again 2 weeks later. And I think that's the danger with an early wildcard. Obviously, yeah, you get some advantages from team value, but at the same time, it's worth saying that a player that you bought a 9.5 that's dropped twice, you're in a better position than someone who buys them at 9.3, because you're going to get profit on the first two price rises straight away, because you recover that. You recover the drop. So even then, I think the team value thing can be a little bit overrated with the market as volatile as it is. We saw a lot of people sell Son before game week three. Before game week two and four. Yeah, I sold him before game week two, partly because of team value considerations. And partly because I thought James Rodriguez offered similar points for less value. And I would have got that 0.1 back. Selling for a team value consideration there assumes that the price drop is going to be lasting until the point where you want to sell them. Whereas if you think they're a good pick, they're likely to score points and therefore recover some of the drop anyway.
That's right. Which brings us nicely probably to Timo Werner, who is currently stinking up both of our teams down to 9.3 and probably going to fall again in the international break. Hard decisions for owners. What do you make of Timo Werner's start at Chelsea and what are your plans?
I think it's fair to say that his start at Chelsea has been disappointing. No one is really questioning that. There's a lot of unknowns. So he started the first game up front and they had a weird system where they played Kai Havertz on the right. And that didn't work because he can't defend and he's clearly more influential through the centre, which they've now realised, and they're playing Timo Werner off the left and Tammy Abraham up front. But they have no fit wingers, and that's about to change. So Christian Pulisic was back on the bench and I think came on last game week. And Timo Werner also has Southampton next, and he has a lot of pace, should be able to exploit a high line, and Southampton are a weak defence on the numbers. Meanwhile, a lot of the good alternatives, so I'm thinking probably the best one is Calvert-Lewin, has Liverpool this week. Jimenez has a bad fixture. Leeds. Well, Danny Ings obviously has Chelsea. And I think game week six looks like a much nicer time to make a move. Now, in terms of my team, I'm in a little bit of a bind. I'm in a spot where I wish you could roll a third free transfer, but I'll get into that a bit later. What are your thoughts on Timo Werner?
Yeah, just the same. I mean, I don't really like picking players who are new to the league. I don't tend to do it that much. And Werner looked to be just a really good option from the start of this year based on the numbers and the models that had tried to scale his production to the Premier League all looked really good. It looked like he was a little bit underpriced is what you're saying. Whenever you pick someone, you kind of think that they're good value for what you get paying for. And the start has just been so unideal with Chelsea and him being kind of shoved around and like stuck out on the left and becoming quite marginalized in the last few games. He hasn't put up good numbers. He hasn't put up like good shooting numbers and whatnot. And yeah, Chelsea have looked quite dysfunctional generally, but they probably should. I mean, at the moment, they're probably just worse than last year because they don't have Willian. And they also don't have Pulisic and they don't have Ziyech. So they're probably just worse going forward despite having Werner and Havertz, because it's just a dysfunctional attack with like hardly any width. So ordinarily, the play for me would be an easy roll, because this time we get to, after the international break with Pulisic and maybe Ziyech coming back, you might get to see Werner in his proper role. You know, maybe Jorginho's not on the pitch and he takes a penalty, and maybe everything clicks for Chelsea and he's getting great supply and other people that are doing damage to the defence and creating space for him and whatnot. This is the first game that we might get to see what he's like. And it's a good fixture, like you say. He's actually one of my better fixtures this week that I've got coming up. I would ordinarily want to keep him without thinking about it too much, but the price kind of pressure is slightly annoying. If he falls again before... Well, he probably will fall again before the game week deadline, and I'll probably just suck it up. I really just want to see the Southampton game, hopefully with Chelsea being more fit and him having had more time to acclimatise. So I am definitely kind of really keen to see this game. He's going to probably be impossible to hold if it's more of the same. If he's out on the left and putting up no XG, then I think I can move him on with a clear conscience and wait to see, find a good time for coming back around to him. But if he's up front and does well, then I'll be happy that I've held him. I still am not giving up on Werner yet.
That's a nice little segue. What are your plans for the next week and kind of looking forward over the next few weeks?
I don't have too many plans, concrete plans at the moment. I want to see how things settle down a bit. Like, I took those two hits and I really like the way my team is set up now. I've got Werner, Calvert-Lewin and Mitrovic, who like could become someone else if you don't like Mitrovic. And then Salah, KDB and Foden. And of course, we're delighted about Foden getting all these minutes and very confident that that'll turn into points really soon. Although I see people are talking about selling him, which is a shame, but doesn't really bother me, like we say. And then I'm tending to play four defenders. I've got Trent and Robertson now, the two Liverpool defenders, and a few other guys like a Bolly from Wolves and Justin and Ayling. So I'm like rotating them in the fourth spot and maybe sometimes rotating Suchek. So my strategy was like to go with quite a deep bench, go with a really safe team that would be kind of bulletproof and let me kind of ride out the craziness of the first few weeks. And it's been even more crazy than I thought, but my strategy just now is just to move into problem solving mode if I can. Like, if Werner is my problem next week, then I just solve that problem and like take each week as it comes, trust that the squad in general is good, and just play. You know, that to me, that's my kind of normal operating mode in FPL, is like looking for the value guys. We're going to get really good information in the next 4 weeks about, like, once we've got like 8 game weeks of data, 10 weeks of data, game weeks of data, about who's going to be the long-term value picks, and try and like keep squeezing those guys into the team and making it more and more optimal. How about you? You were thinking about turning Werner into Son, weren't you? Which a lot of people will be thinking about doing.
Yeah, I've got headaches aplenty. I almost wish I had one free transfer now, because I would roll and wait for game week 6. But I don't think... I'm not that satisfied with my team. I've got a front line of Antonio, Werner and Wood, which is okay. I'm pretty happy with Antonio. Obviously, the fixtures aren't great. Wood is okay. I think he's at least got West Brom next, so I don't want to move him on now. And Werner's got Southampton. So there's some problems there, but nothing I want to solve in the coming game week. The midfield is mostly fine. Salah and Sterling are all good. Foden, agree on the minutes, is probably even better than I thought. I think he's one of the best value players in the game. I've got James Rodriguez. He looks fantastic. And Suchek. So that's all fine. And then the back line looks mostly fine. James, Justin got minutes. Sice is good. Ayling and Trent. But I have an issue with Reece James. Obviously, he didn't start the last game week. So in an ideal world, I'd want to wait for more information on a lot of things. I'd want to wait for more information on Reece James. Yeah. I'd want to wait until Werner has the Southampton fixture out the way. I would want to wait until Wood has the West Brom fixture out the way. And there's a lot of moves that I want to make, but I don't really want to make any of them this game week. But I have 2 free transfers.
So you're hoping that someone gets COVID, maybe that on international break. That would be.
I was, you know, almost relieved when Son got COVID in the fake tweet that I referenced earlier in the pod, because it just meant that I didn't have to worry about that transfer. It's difficult because I want to upgrade Reece James rather than downgrade, but because I have nothing in the bank, I can't do that with a single free transfer. So I'd need to make other moves to free up money to move him to someone like Semedo or Chilwell. So I have a big headache and I really have no idea what I want to do. I may well go with Werner and Suchek into Brewster and Son.
Yeah.
But I slept on it and now I'm as confused as I was before.
Yeah, it sounds like a good thing to like sit on your hands until we get all the information back from the internationals. I mean, I just want to quickly flag that I don't wish COVID or any injury or illness on anybody. I'm talking at the moment as a pathological, psychopathic FPL manager who all he cares about is his FPL team. But obviously,
a winning, optimized robot.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, sometimes it's nice in FPL for me when you kind of get the decision made for you. I don't object to that at all. I think I've got problems with being overly indecisive. And I often roll a free transfer and then oftentimes find myself in your shoes now where you kind of want to roll again. It sounds like indecisiveness to me, actually. But it is just a really hard point in the season where it's kind of still a bit early to make big shouts if you think that the shouts that you made from game week one are more or less right. Something I just wanted to talk about was there's a lot of players that are getting sold that are good and that I thought were good before game week one and have been actually even better than that in the season. And I'm thinking about people like Suchek, Antonio, Shea Adams, and there's probably more that I'm forgetting. But I mean, maybe this is where the fact that we're looking at the underlying expected stats rather than the kind of headline goals and assists numbers comes in. But it's quite odd, isn't it? Like, Shea Adams is getting lots of minutes and putting up really big numbers, and he's already 5.8. You know, he's going to be probably one of the better value picks in the game quite soon. Mitrovic is 5.9. He's done nothing wrong. What do you have, like, any takes on that?
Yeah, I think this is quite bizarre. I understand players like Shea Adams and Mitrovic dropping because people are always going to react to the outcomes rather than the underlying numbers. And I think in the case of Mitrovic, he's putting up reasonable numbers, but you can understand people looking at Fulham and just going, I can't have a player from this attack because they create nothing.
Yes.
It's just demoralizing as a manager. Now, Antonio kind of baffles me because he has 2 goals in 4 games.
Yeah.
He's returned reasonably well. I know the fixtures over the next 3 are really tough, but if you transfer him out now, you're almost certainly going to want him back for the easiest fixture he's going to have all year in game week 8. So you spend, what, 2 transfers in 3 game weeks?
So, like, if you're transferring him out, you're talking about, you know, you would expect to earn 2, 3, 4 points from those 2 transfers. So, you know, in an ordinary world. So it doesn't seem like an efficient use of 2 free transfers to me at all. But his underlying numbers as well have been great. Like, the thing that I really wanted to see was him playing up front, because we didn't know if he was going to be there or if it was going to be Haller or who it was going to be now that everyone was fit. And he is playing up front and he looks really good, and he might be on penalties when Noble's not on the pitch and Noble's not been getting all the minutes. He's someone that I would be looking to buy, and Shea Adams is someone I'd be looking to buy as well. The numbers are good, so maybe just, you know, I would encourage, I think people who are listening to this are already doing this, but I would, now more than ever is when you're going to see the most noise in the difference between outcomes and expected outcomes. And if you want something that's going to steer you better for the future, look at the expected outcomes now. You know, at least even now it's a small sample, but it's so much more reliable than the actual sample of goals and assists that are coming through so far, because that's just almost like pure noise, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What a confusing few weeks, eh?
It has been, but, you know, we remain resolute. We'll continue here nodding along like we knew it was going to happen, and being annoyed by our players not scoring points in FPL. That's a constant, you know. At least there's that makes it feel like home for me.
Yep, that's true. It's that familiar disappointment.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else?
I think familiar disappointment is a good place to leave it. It's hopefully not what our listeners are feeling right now.
Yeah. It's becoming familiar anyway.
Cool. Well, in that case, to everyone listening, subscribe if you can, leave us a review. I'm going to steal Mike Goodman's line, make us happy as podcasters. And we'll catch you in a month. Bye from me.
Bye.